Hello, everyone. This is Roldarathis, or Jeff, with the Toilet of Hell, and I've got a very special guest with me today, the Cleaver of Alicorns, Dane Cross of Sacred Sun. How's it going today?
I'm good. I'm good. Thank you for having me in your toilet.
Of course, you're welcome in my toilet anytime.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. Thank you.
All right, so I figure I'll just get into it. I've got a couple questions for you about your new LP, number two, Arthurian Catacombs. So, what's the significance of the title, given that the first album was self-titled?
The significance is that the story that powers the album and the concepts and themes of the album are inspired by Arthurian, well, they're inspired by many things, but predominantly Arthurian legend. And I also wanted to endow the album with a medieval motif. So the word Arthurian just seemed to apply to those to that criteria. So I went with that, and then Catacombs because it's also an album about death and grief. And Catacombs, I think, are one of the few places where we're forced to come to terms with our own mortality in a very direct and explicit way. So those two words came naturally, and like I say, because of the concept that drives the album, it seemed to be a fitting title.
Yeah, I actually recently was over in Poland for a trip, and I went to some very old catacombs, and they're definitely a very special place with just the
Indeed.
yeah. So, how's the reception been so far? Has it been positive or?
Very positive. I've nearly sold out of the first run of CDs, which I'm very happy with. The reviews I've read have been largely positive. It's been nice to see people talking more about the music than the cover art this time. Strangely enough, the talking point seems to be more centered on the instrumental tracks that break up the parts of the album, as well as the logo as well. I think some people aren't so keen on the new logo. I guess that is part of the cover, but it was nice that people are focusing more on other aspects of the album rather than the conversation being dominated purely by the artwork. So, but yeah, I've been very pleased with the reception so far, for sure.
That's great. So yeah, my next question was actually about the logo. So it's fairly common for artists to go through different logos, as their sound or career evolves. But was there? I mean, it sounds like you already kind of answered this question. Like, you went for a more regal design based on the Arthurian aspect.
Correct. Yes. And I was never particularly wedded to the first logo per se. And I was going for a more of a, shall we say, a more medieval looking, almost like like made out of smoke, kind of effect. And it was actually even before the first album was released, I was drafting some logos myself, and I came across this particular one and thought, I really like this one. I'm not sure why I didn't go with this one originally. So it's yeah, it could in another world it could have been the Sacred Sun logo from the offset, but yeah, I obviously originally went with the first logo, but it's interesting seeing the reaction to the change there. Obviously some good and some not so good, but I guess that's a good thing. It's nice to divide opinion.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I noticed when I was listening through Catacombs that there's more of a showcase on riffs this time around than like the caustic kind of wall of sound atmospheres of the self-title. Was that like a conscious decision or just kind of how the songs came out this time?
It was a conscious decision, yeah. I wanted to create more of a traditional second wave sounding black metal album this time, as opposed to the atmospheric dynamic that accompanied the first album. And I guess with that, it means that like you say, the songs are going to be more riff heavy and you know, rely more on those kind of hooks than just a really dense atmospheric barrage of guitars, which was what characterized the first album, I feel. So it was certainly a conscious decision. Like some of the albums that I was influenced by this time around, like a lot of Dark Throne, Under a Funeral Moon, and Panzerfaust, those kinds of albums. If you listen to those, then you know they have some really impressive and just really excellent riffs. And you know, Dark Throne is still doing that to this day, which blows my mind. It was a conscious decision to make it more of a riffier album this time around, and you know, include guitar solos and stuff like that, and shift the dynamic to slower parts and not have it a wall-to-wall blast beat album as the first one was.
Yeah, one of our writers, Black Metal Porkins, this is his tag, specifically mentioned Dark Throne and that Under a Funeral Moon album. So like, yeah, the sadness, like,
good.
Yeah, just like he mentioned the word that stuck with me from when we were talking is like it's like brassy almost, the sound, like it's very, like, for lack of a better word, the sound is very like, it's almost like a, it's metallic sounding, not like the genre, but just it sounds like, yeah, it's hard to describe, but it's like
I know what you mean, like things clashing together and yeah, I can see what they were saying. Yeah, and a lot of effort went into making it sound that, to make it sound lo-fi and kind of unpleasant on the ear, I suppose, in fitting with that, with the second wave black metal artists, the albums that this was inspired by. Like the producer kept on going to use these certain plugins that he would usually use in a recording session, and he had to really prevent himself from doing so because we were trying to emulate this early 90s recording sound. We didn't have the tools or the capacity to replicate it 100% genuinely, but we tried to give it a good go. To get the sound that characterizes this album, it did take quite a lot of experimentation and putting our heads together and just experimenting with stuff. But I'm pleased with the result, and I think how your friend described it, I think that's quite, I know I'd consider that a compliment, quite brassy and metallic sounding in a literal sense.
Yeah. So I just have a few questions now about the transformation from Sigurd Sun from a solo project to a full-fledged band on this new album. So what's like the most challenging aspect of becoming a full band, and maybe the most rewarding aspect as well?
The most challenging, I guess, is, you know, we're going from when it was a one-person project, it was just me who had to learn everything and remember all of the riffs and the songs and the structures and everything, because it was just me recording. But when you get a whole bunch of guys together, then it's a new challenge entirely, because everyone needs to, not only do we individually need to learn our specific parts, but we then need to come to the practice room and just repeatedly rehearse until we're all tight and we all gel together musically, and that doesn't happen overnight. You know, it takes quite a while to get to a sufficient enough standard where we can play and we're comfortable and we're completely familiar with the set, and we know that we're going to put on a good show. And that's taken time. I mean, we played our first show last April, and I guess we'd only been a full band for maybe a couple of months. And we did record that performance, and I do listen back to it sometimes, and I think, oh man, we've come on so much more strongly since then, and we're a lot tighter, and we understand each other as musicians, and we just gel together so much better now because so much time has passed since then. We've played a few more gigs, and we put a lot of hours into the practice studio. So that's a challenge in its own right, that you're essentially starting from scratch. And it would be, even if you've got a band that's been together for a long time and then you replace one member, then in a sense you're starting from scratch because that member has to, get up to standard, get up to scratch with the rest of the band. So I think that was probably one of the biggest challenges. And then what's the most rewarding part? I'd say that just having more opinions and having members in the band who are a lot more talented at their respective instruments than I am, because even though I can play all the instruments required for the first album to a certain level, I'm by no means an expert at any of them. So having guys who are better at their instruments to come in, and then they can play the parts a lot better probably in a live scenario, and B, they have the creative license to bring things to the table that I might not otherwise have considered. There's a ton of stuff on this record that was just these guys, just their idea, that they just contributed themselves, and the record is a lot stronger because of that. Especially, I don't want to single anyone out, but the drummer Jamie is a fantastic drummer. He's an absolute machine. He's just, he throws in these ridiculous fills and little accents and stuff, and I just think, man, where did you think of that? It sounds great. That I could be sat behind this kit for 100 years and I never would have thought to include something like that. So, and a lot of the time it's something really unconventional, but it just ends up working, so that, and plus just a general camaraderie as well. It's nice. It's just a nice experience, being in the practice room with these guys and playing shows. It's it's more of a team ethic, which really helps the band, I think.
Yeah. So when you'd started off the project as a solo, one man band, were you at that point thinking that you would eventually want to be playing live, or was it just, or did that come later?
Well, no, that came later. At the time, I never really thought that this project would extend past the first album. It was always just a little passion project, I guess. I just wanted to try out and then, put it behind me and focus on other stuff. It all kind of happened by accident, which is a phrase I frequently deploy when I'm talking about Sacred Sun, because pretty much everything has happened by accident. So it wasn't really, by popular demand, and just the fact that I thought that this would be a fun thing to bring to the stage if I can find the necessary members to join the band. So, and because we were also offered gigs, and this was before playing live was even in the conversation, and I was having to say, this isn't a full band, this is just me, and I can't do this live without a full band. So, and then I eventually thought, why not? This might be fun. So, got the guys together, Mark and Stuart, the guitarists. I was in a band with them a few years ago, and when it came to an end, we stayed good friends. So those are the first two guys that I approached about the idea, and they were up for it. And then Jamie, the drummer, got in touch. The drummer is always the hardest member to find, as I'm sure anyone will attest to. So he was, I put a thing out on Facebook saying, if you're based in London and you want to play drums in the band, then get in touch. And we tried a few guys out, and some of them are really, really good, but just either didn't, I don't know, they didn't work out for whatever reason, or they maybe lacked the sufficient experience. And then Jamie got in touch and sent me some videos of him playing, and I was just like, well, this guy, we need to get this guy in. So he came in, we tried him out, and then it all clicked together. And then we were away, and we had our first gig in April, like I say, and we've just continued it since.
Awesome. So do you feel like playing with a full band has made your connection to the music any less intimate, or has it made it more intimate?
About the same, I would say. I still wrote this album in the same way that I wrote the first one, in that I write everything at home on my old laptop. It's like 5 years old now or something, and I use GarageBand because, you know, it came with a laptop or whatever, and I'm too cheap to purchase actual recording software. So I recorded it all. I record all the demos at home in GarageBand, and then send the tracks to the other guys, and then give them the tabs, and then we go to the practice room, and then the song comes to life, I guess. I suppose that's the difference between the first record and this one, in that I had the novelty of hearing the songs as a actual song rather than just a crappy demo version that exists purely in GarageBand. So that gave me quite an intimate relationship with the music, because it's one thing listening to a really shoddily recorded track in GarageBand with a MIDI drum kit that just sounds awful. I mean, the first album, I put out a limited edition version which had one of the demo tracks on it. So if anyone got that, then they will understand how the difference between the demo version and the actual recorded version, and just how much of a leap it takes in terms of production once it's been recorded. So it was a great luxury to be able to go in the studio and then play the song, and then it's like the song's just come to life, and then I can get a really good understanding of what's working, what isn't working, and make changes from there. So having a full band certainly helped the songwriting process, definitely.
All right. So the ambient tracks on Catacombs, you know, they're numbered in sequence, and that suggests to me continuity. Is there like you had said that the overall theme might be about Arthurian legend. Is there a storyline to each one of the non-numbered tracks take up a particular part of that mythology, or are they more palate cleansers for the blasting and shrieking?
There are a little bit of both. The first one, Ossuary 1, is to set the tone of the album and to gear you up for the second track. One of the things that I really liked about the first album was after the third track, which is the interlude song, the fourth track comes, just bashes straight in, and it's quite quite impactful, I feel, because you're in a different world sonically. You're relaxed, and your mind's off the blast beats and the chaos and the abrasiveness of the rest of the album, and then just out of nowhere, bang, this track comes in, and it's something that obviously I'm not the first person to do that. I think it was actually a Death Spell Omega record that first did that to me. I forget which one, but there's about a 4 minute, maybe 5 minute passage of chanting, and it's really beautiful, and then just out of nowhere it just kicks back in, and it's super, super heavy, and it really, really got me. So that was more playing with that kind of idea this time around for the opening track. It does also characterize the album in that it's supposed to represent entering the catacombs of the title, and you hear this swelling breaths coming from within, and it's meant to be, you know, disorientating, and it intensifies, and you're deep into the place, into the catacombs, and then the album really starts with the second track. And then Ossuary 2, which was actually written not by me but by Stuart, one of the guitarists, the spoken word in it is based upon a painting called Wealthy Man Being Led to Hell. And in fact, the final three tracks all form the second. So the actual the album is in two parts, which is difficult to get across digitally because obviously on Spotify and Bandcamp and all the rest of it, you don't really get the means to split them into two parts unless you did it like a multiple CD thing. But, you know, I didn't want to do that. So it's two parts, and the second part serves as a triptych, or however the hell you pronounce it, but like one of those paintings where it's split into three parts. And so Ossuary 2, which is the first part of that, of the triptych or whatever, is based upon the painting Wealthy Man Being Led to Hell by James Tavernier the Younger. And again, I might not pronounce that right. And that's about, as the title suggests, it's a painting of a man being led to hell, a wealthy man being led to hell because he's greedy and he refuses to give a leper the food that's fallen from his table because he's a greedy son of a bitch or whatever. So he goes to hell, and then the leper dies, and then he goes to heaven because he's virtuous and good of soul or whatever. So Ossuary 2 is about that. And then Ossuary 3, even though it's an instrumental track, I wrote that. That's also based on another painting. In fact, the second part of the album, they're all based on individual paintings. And that last track is also based on a painting. I can't remember off the top of my head what it's called, but it's basically another vision of hell from, I don't know, like 500 BC or no, AD or something around then. So they do have, even though they are, like you say, they are palate cleansers of sorts to break up the chaos of the rest of the album, so to speak, they do also have their own meaning and significance to the overall narrative that drives the album.
Cool. So yeah, it's funny that you should mention that, like the ambient kind of more relaxed, if not like a little creepy, the songs. Like I was listening to this album the other day, and Ossuary 2 into Arachnidan Appendage, like I almost shit myself. I was just,
that's good.
My heart was just like just exploding out of my chest. I was like, wow, that was really intense.
Okay, no, that's good. That's good. That was my intention. I love albums that do that. They dictate your mood and your present state of mind, and they can just out of nowhere, just like you say, just scare the shit out of you. And you're like, whoa, I forgot I was listening to a metal album or whatever. So it's, yeah, it's one of the powers that I like to deploy every now and then. It's a lot of fun, and it just keeps you on your toes, you know. I feel with a lot of black or death metal albums or whatever, when it's wall to wall blast beats and just metal, it can almost turn into white noise eventually. Even if it's a really really good album, if you listen to it to the full length, you can kind of feel your concentration start to waver. But if it starts to go somewhere else dynamically and tonally, and then all of a sudden it just comes out of nowhere back into, you know, shrieky blast beat town. It really captures your attention and your imagination, I feel.
Dynamics in my extreme metal? What the hell are you thinking?
I know. I was very, it took a daring step there, but hopefully it paid off.
So this is a little bit of a personal question, but I hope it isn't too much. You're currently releasing albums without record label backing. You know, is that a personal choice to be more do it yourself, or are people just sleeping on the sun?
Well, I did off the back of the first album, I thought maybe I should approach some labels, see if they might be interested. And a couple did get back, a couple of good, well, what I consider to be good and quite high profile labels got back and were keen to work with me. But this is all because of lack of preparation on my part. There's a bit of a waiting list, I guess, because they've already got so many releases lined up, they couldn't facilitate the release until like next year or half, or maybe even later, like late next year or maybe in 2021. And because I'd already foolishly jumped the gun and announced the release date for the 25th of August, 2 years to the day after the first one, I didn't really want to put that off and put the release date back just to accommodate the possibility of it being released on a label. A few other smaller labels also got in touch, but I don't know. I had to weigh up the pros and cons, I guess, of letting of getting a label involved who would probably do a really great job of promoting the album and taking care of all of the menial jobs of, like packaging up CDs and LPs and stuff and sending them out, which is not an enviable task. In fact, I just did that yesterday for this album, and it wasn't so bad actually. I had some help this time around, which was good because I'd kind of prepared. I'd learned some lessons from the first album and was a little bit more prepared for how to send stuff out. Like, for example, printing out shipping labels saves you about 4 hours because you're not writing every single address, which is just incredibly time consuming. So that was not so difficult this time. And that for me, that would have been the biggest advantage of having a label involved in that they could take care of all that stuff. But along with that, of course, comes a cost in that they might say, we'll get the LPs made for you. We'll take care of all the CDs and the rest of it. We'll just give you a certain percentage back. And although this, at the end of the day, this project isn't for me for making any money beyond what I put in to record stuff and to get stuff made, like the CDs and the LPs and stuff. But for me, it just wasn't really, I don't know, it didn't quite feel worth it in terms of what I'd be losing in exchange for what I was getting. So for the time being, at least, I would like to continue unsigned and just taking care of everything myself, because it's also quite nice having, complete creative control and just being all over everything. It's quite a nice feeling, and not really having to deal with all of the politics that might come with being signed to a label. Obviously, if the right label did come knocking and the stars were aligned and they had a slot coming up which really suited when I was looking to release a record in the near future, then of course I'd certainly be interested. But for now, I'm quite happy to continue this adventure as just me kind of taking care of all of that stuff.
Cool. So I have a few more general questions, but before I move on, I want to ask you if you want to talk a little bit more about the there's a formal kind of dedication up on about Arthurian Catacombs. I'm just wondering if you want to tell everyone about that, or if it's a little too personal, we can get going on the next question.
On the back of the in the notes of the like the credits and stuff, is that what you mean? So it was so a friend of mine passed away last year quite suddenly and out of the blue, and it was probably about halfway down, halfway through the writing process of this album. So it certainly colored the way that I continued the rest of the album, and just more of the themes and so just the way I approached it, I suppose, the rest of the album, how I wrote it, how the lyrics I wrote, and how I was feeling when I was writing the rest of the songs. So, and he was one of the most enthusiastic of my friends when the first album came out. Like, he was, all he wanted to talk about was that album, and he just found it so hilarious, the reception. And he also, alongside that, he had a lot of sound advice, which I actually took on, and I'm glad I did, because without his advice, then a lot of things might be different with this album. And I'm really grateful for all the advice and, you know, suggestions that he threw at me. You actually hear his voice on the middle bit in Arachnid in Appendage, when it goes kind of quiet and it's clean guitars. You can hear his voice just about somewhere in the mix, because he asked if he could. He used to talk via voice memo on WhatsApp, and it used to drive everyone crazy, because you can't just text someone back when they send you a voice memo. You have to find a time in a day or a quiet place to listen to it. But he sent me the voice memo that's featured in that track, but he also sent me one just saying, can I have a part on your next album, which I nearly included in the album, but it would have just kind of ruined the vibe of it slightly. So I wanted to include him in there somehow. I put his, that bit that you hear in there, he's just basically talking about the first, how much he loved the first album, how funny he found it and all that. That's the guy who it's dedicated to. His name is Al, and yeah, he was a very special friend, and I miss him a lot. But I was glad that I was able to, you know, put this dedication on there for him, because I think he would have found it hilarious, I think. But that's the story behind that.
Well, that's like really touching and haunting at the same time. You know, I'm glad that he was able to be featured in here, and I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Well, now we're gonna go in a completely different direction.
After all that serious stuff's out of the way.
Yeah. So, was the Catacombs cover taken also on vacation? Did you just follow Obsequies to the aria of Vernal Tombs?
No, it was. Sorry, what was the last part of that question?
It just reminded me of the, it reminds me of the ruins on the cover of Obsequies, aria of Vernal Tombs.
Yeah. I wasn't actually. I was aware of the album, actually. I remember it came out 2016, 2015,
somewhere around there.
And it hadn't even occurred to me. And as soon as someone made that connection, I was like, oh shit, people are going to think that I'm totally riffing on that. That wasn't intent. It wasn't intent. That's a great record, by the way. But no, it wasn't intended as a spin or me pointing fun at that in any way. That was pure coincidence. The shot was it wasn't on vacation. It was, we actually drove to this place, me and Mark, one of the guitarists. We went there specifically to take this cover. It's actually in Glastonbury Abbey, which is one of the many places where King Arthur is alleged to have been buried. His tomb is allegedly buried right near those two arches that you see on the front. It was originally going to be in the Catacombs of Paris, but funnily enough, Brexit prevented that from happening, because we were supposed to be going, yeah, fucking Brexit. We were supposed to be going there. When was it? September. We were supposed to be going there in like May to Paris, because I'd been to the Catacombs of Paris before, and it's a really cool place. And I thought, you know what, given the title of the album, this might be a cool place to do it. But actually, in hindsight, that would have been a little bit too much on the nose and a bit, I don't know, I don't think it would have worked. And I think also the lighting down there would have been probably pretty poor. So I'm glad that we went where we did. But we were supposed to be going to Paris in May, and there was a strike at the Channel, I think in Paris, where basically the trains go from London, St. Pancras to Paris, the trains that go under the Channel, and we were going to do that. And all the staff went on strike because of, I think they were unhappy about Brexit, and they thought that not enough planning had been put in, and they thought that they hadn't been compensated well enough to deal with all the stuff that's going to happen as a result of Brexit. So they went on strike, which meant that all of the trains going to, not all of, but most of the services going to and from London, London to Paris, were cancelled. So it meant that our train to Paris was cancelled, which meant we couldn't go and take the photo. And then I thought, I was actually kind of relieved, because like I said, I think that would have been a little bit too much on the nose. So I thought, okay, well, where else is a good place, maybe a little bit closer to home, where we can go and shoot this cover that's relevant to the album title and the Arthurian legend inspired story that powers the album. And I can't remember how I came across it, but I remember seeing these particularly, these arches that looked really, really dramatic and just really impressive. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go there and get it taken there. But yeah, the likeness between that and the, I can't remember her name, Obscure.
No one knows how to pronounce it.
yeah. It's one of those words. Any similarity between that and this cover are purely accidental.
So a more important question, the one that everyone is just dying to know: where are your sunglasses? Yeah. It's bright out there.
Oh, they're actually in my pocket.
So they're spiritually in the image.
They are. Yeah, they're still in there. We took a few shots, and we took a few with the shades, and I don't know. I can't remember the logic behind my decision, but I don't know. Something just drove me towards the one where I'm not wearing shades, and it kind of you can kind of see that I'm facing the sun, and my eyes are kind of squinting because it's like right in my face. So I'm not quite sure why I didn't go with that one. I wanted something to differentiate from the first cover, and I didn't want it to become the gimmick that would endure for the rest of my songwriting days, you know. So yeah, they went in the pocket, but you know, they are still there if you look close enough.
Yeah, we were me and some of the other toilet folks who were kind of we were wondering if there was a symbolism in this shedding of the glasses, but now we have the explanation. They're in the pocket.
Yeah. No symbolism, I'm afraid. No. I feel sometimes it's better to let people come to their own conclusions, because it's often a lot more interesting than the truth. But in this occasion, I'm willing to be more forthcoming and admit that there was no particular significance with the sunglasses on this occasion.
So I'm guessing that you've received a glut of hate mail based on the art from your first album. Do you have like a most excellent hate mail experience from black metal nerds?
Oh. Well, good question. My friend actually, I didn't see this. My friend found it. I think it was it must have been on YouTube somewhere, but some guy was obviously very affronted by the artwork. And he said, I'll pay someone good money to curb stomp this guy if they ever see him, which was like, wow, okay, you're really angry. Yeah, it's kind of galling when you see something like that written about you. That was probably the most vitriolic response I came across. And the rest of it, I don't know. I mean, there's been this ongoing narrative, I suppose, that people, that a lot of people, you know, a majority of people, in fact, in the black metal community took offense and were angry about this cover. But I think it was, I'd say, from what I've read, I mean, which is by no means everything, but from the responses that I've come across, the reception was largely positive, I think. It seems to comprise of, you know, this is a weird cover, but listen to the music because you might actually like it, and which was quite nice, you know. There was, of course, that, I think it was Decibel magazine, that guy wrote the article, and he seemed to be quite angry about everything. In fact, I'd probably say, now I think of it, maybe that guy's response was the best, because he went to the trouble to write an entire article about it, which is quite funny when you think about it. And there was, I think that was probably, I can't remember the dude's name, but he classed it as C plus grade black metal, I think, which I think is quite good. Like, if I consider that a compliment, you know, it's probably higher than what I would grade my music, to be honest. So even though he was pissed off about the reception, I don't think he was necessarily pissed off about me or the cover itself. I think it was more the reaction that he wasn't too happy about, and people telling him that he couldn't take a joke or whatever because he you know, wasn't a fan of the album or whatever. So I think he was more frustrated with those people more than myself. But I thought, C plus black metal, like, that's a good thing, right?
I mean, there's a plus in it. That sounds good to me. Also, that's a very, it's a very specific grade. It's like, so you gave it a 79. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's, I wonder how long he was agonizing. It was like, maybe he wrote C originally, and then he thought, no, that's too cool. I better put a plus on the end.
that is silly. One other question, about kind of, we're kind of edging over that way. You seem pretty vocal from it, past discussions that I've heard from you about your anti-fascist views. What are your thoughts on the current state of, like, the black metal scene, and do you have any close encounters with these NSBM dorks?
Well, I was featured in a Vice article that Kim Kelly, a Noisy article that Kim Kelly wrote a few months ago, maybe it was about a year ago. And to my surprise, she, even though I'd never, like, the lyrics of the first album, I mean, they're in Norwegian anyway, and I can't really remember what I even, what the lyrics even are. I need to dig them out because they've been translated to Norwegian for such a long time, I've kind of forgot what the English translations are. So there's never anything lyrically on that album that was particularly anti-fascist or even political in any capacity, really. And then I saw this article, and it was about anti-fascist black metal, and name dropped a few anti-fascist black metal bands like, you know, Neckbeard, Death Camp, and Dawn Raid, and guys like that. And to see myself in there, I was like, whoa, that's, you know, I'm flattered, and I'm glad that I've been included in this list. And she's absolutely right, you know, I identify as as left leaning, and I'm a member of the UK Labour Party, and I'm a democratic socialist through and through, so I obviously oppose fascism in all its forms. And so I was really, really grateful and really charmed to be included in that list. And then when I posted the link, it's weird because the link's disappeared since. I don't know where it's gone, but I had to post it again. But when I originally posted the link, there was a lot of NSBM dorks, as you put it, getting really riled up and, you know, like, You've blown it. I'm never listening to you again, and fuck you, and all of this, and just getting really pissed off about that. And I thought, at what point did you look at my album cover and think, yeah, this guy is definitely a neo-Nazi, or he shares my shitty fascist views, or whatever? I don't know. It's strange that people would have associated me with that anyway prior to me sharing that article. So I was a bit mystified by that. But I'm glad, because those guys can fuck right off. Like, they don't deserve to listen to my music anyway, if they sympathize with National Socialist black metal artists or fascism or whatever, So that was probably the only experience I had with them. I then reshared the article, and then the reaction was a lot more muted. I don't think anyone really, I guess the people who previously thought that I might share their fascist sympathies would probably have unliked the page or whatever, so they probably didn't see the article when I shared it the second time around. So there wasn't as much of a reaction from that particular sect second time around. But yeah, I think that's probably my only brush in with those sorts of people. Yeah.
Thankfully.
Thankfully, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just have a few more questions, and then
Yeah, yeah.
that's pretty much what I got for you. But I'm just wondering if you want to
Great.
plug any upcoming UK metal bands or any genre really that you think more people should be aware of or listening to.
Oh yeah, good question. I think most people are familiar with Dawn Raid, there, which kind of ties in with the previous question there. Obviously a very vocally anti-fascist black metal band. I think they're working on a, or they have been working on a new album, which I think will be out soon. So anyone who isn't aware of Dawn Raid should definitely check that out, because they're a fantastic band. And yeah, who else? So when we play in London, so I put a lot on a lot of my own shows around London. Well, I say a lot, I've done like three, but when I have the energy and motivation to put on my own show in and around London, my friend, well, they're friends of the band now, a band called Nomos, which is spelled Nomos. They're a two-piece black metal band, and they are, and if you listen to them, you wouldn't believe it. And even when you witness them live, the amount of noise they make and the amount of energy they have, it's just, they could easily be a four or a five-piece band. They're just so fucking good. So I'd advise people check them out for sure.
Cool. All right, so I it would be disingenuous of me not to mention the sun posting phenomenon, as it's become known to myself and some of the people on the Toilet of Hell. I explained it to you in brief earlier, just so you wouldn't think I was a serial killer. But if you knew how many of these things I've made, you'd probably reconsider that.
Oh, okay.
So I'm gonna go ahead and speak for the community at large here over the toilet, but
Yeah,
a lot of these folks appreciate what you stand for, and we you and your aesthetic, your fun aesthetic, and your solid music, you become a bonding experience kind of for all of us, like a muse.
oh, that's good.
Yeah, we like it's just any if you go to any article of ours and search for control F sun. You're gonna
Yeah.
probably find your face in the comment section, photoshopped onto a ghost or something. And it's
Right. Okay.
so, yeah,
That's fantastic.
you should stop by sometime and check that out because
Yeah.
you might get a kick out of some of these. I mean, I
Yeah.
have some in a folder that I want to share with you, but
Oh,
that wouldn't really
please.
work on the radio, but I'll send them to you just for your
Oh,
own
man. Yeah.
enjoyment.
Yeah, it's always a surreal experience seeing my face photoshopped on different things. I remember you guys did an article like a few weeks after the first one came out on classic black metal covers, and it was yeah, it was entertaining, shall we say. And a lot of, and my friends loved it as well. So yeah, the more power to you. It's always it's always a funny thing to see.
Awesome. Well, never. I want to tell you to never stop wearing blazers on your album covers and just keep being you, doing you. That's. I guess I. If you have anything else you want to say before we head out, the floor is yours. Otherwise, I hope you have a great rest of your day, and thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks, man. No, this has been really, really fun. I'll just say everyone who's bought a copy of a new album, thank you very much. And anyone who's bought the first album as well, thank you also. And anyone who's listened or come to one of our shows and all the rest of it, thank you for your support. And, you know, people like you guys who let me come on their show and talk nonsense for an hour, that's also really appreciated. And yeah, keep an eye out for further announcements, because there's more exciting stuff happening very soon. In fact, I'm probably gonna announce something straight after this call, and I guess by the time anyone listens to this, that will be in the past, so you would already be aware of it. But thank you very much for all your support.
You're very welcome. Take care, Dane.
Thank you very much. You too.
All right. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.